Marion. Cars the color of melons and tangerines sizzled in cul-de-sac driveways. Dogs lay belly up and heaving in the shade. It was cooler in the hills, where Marion's family lived. Everyone who stayed at their ranch was some relative, Marion said, blood or otherwise, and she called everyone brother or sister. The main house jutted up from the ranch land, as serene and solitary as a ship, crusted with delicate Victorian detailing that gathered dirt in its cornices and spirals. The first owner had been a date heiress, Marion told me, adored and indulged, and her girlish fancies were evident in the oval windows that opened inward, the drained pond that had once been thick with water lilies and exotic fish. Palm fronds fell crisped from the trees that flanked the house's exterior. All the landscaping was now like an afterimage, long grown over but visible in the heights of grass, in the lines of trees that extended a path to the front door, bordered by white plaster columns. We spent most of our time in the airy rooms of the main house. We watched the babies there, cradled them and sang, dangled glass beads on strings over their damp faces. We put together whatever puzzles were around, broke castles or glossy kittens in baskets, starting over as soon as we had finished. I found a book on massage, with fold-out graphs of pressure points, and we practiced. Marion lying on her stomach, her shirt pushed up, me straddling her and moving my hands across her back in firm circles, my palms slick and yellowed with oil. Marion had just turned 13. I was 11. My mother was going through a phase then, having night sweats and blackouts. She paid people to touch her, her naturopath, who placed warm fingers on her neck, her breast, the Chinese acupuncturist, who scraped her naked body with a plane of polished wood. I ended up at Marion's for weeks at a time, my clothes mixed in with hers, her half-brother stealing small bills from me, her father, Bobby, kissing Marion and me goodnight square on the mouth. One afternoon, we sat on the front steps of the main house, sharing root beer and watching her father dig pits in the yard. Later, he would line them with leaves and fill them with apples. "I need cigarettes," Marion moaned, passing me the bottle. I sipped the root beer with adult weariness. "Let's ask Jack for some," she said, not looking at me. Jack was Bobby's friend, visiting from Portland. He was rangy, the pale hairs on his arms neon against his tanned skin. He had been staying in the barn with his girlfriend Grady, who wore long skirts and ribbons around her ponytail. At dinner, when Grady lifted her arms to retie her bow, I saw dark hair under her arms and averted my eyes. "It's not like it's a big deal. He'll share," Marion said, pinching a thread from the hem of her cutoffs. Marion was wearing her shorts over her favorite bright orange bikini, nubby fabric stretched tight across her breasts, her shoulders shining from sunscreen. I was wearing a swimsuit top, too, borrowed from Marion, and all day I had felt an anxious thrill from the strange feeling of air on my chest and my stomach. Marion raised her eyebrows at me when I didn't answer. "We're wearing these 'cause it's hot, okay? Don't worry so much." Men stared at her when she wore that suit, and she liked it. When Jack first came for dinner at the ranch, he would follow Marion with his eyes when she got up from the table. That day, when Jack watched Marion in the barn as he rolled a cigarette for her, I felt a flint of heat in my insides. When he glanced at me, I turned and hunched my shoulders, trying to relieve the strain of my breasts against the borrowed fabric. I never went out in that swimsuit again. None of us knew then that bark beetles were tunneling in the trees, laying millions of eggs that would wipe out millions of trees. Bobby was warning of an attack so great that the United States would fold in on itself like a fist. It was the men's job to protect the women. Everyone who lived at the ranch was storing things, freezing food in huge, unbelievable quantities, and clearing brush out of old Indian caves and catching water there in jugs. Bobby wanted to build a stone tower, 40 feet high and circular, on top of a hill where the energy was paramagnetic and auspicious. They circled the site with silk flags and burning oils before they started construction. Marion and I watched from the hillside, slapping the mosquitoes on our legs. He was storing arms, Bobby said, for the wars, and we never quite knew if he was joking or not. Marion rolled her eyes at him all the time, but swallowed the foul-tasting Coptis tincture he gave us each morning for regular bowel movements and thick hair. "Like a pony's," he said, and twisted Marion's braid around his wrist. Her family staked their marijuana plants on south-facing hillsides and planted them with sage and basil. They told their friends they had 30 plants, but they had five times that many, hidden all over the ranch. They sold to a dispensary in Los Angeles, and sometimes, if my mother was away for the weekend on an extreme juice fast, Marion and I were allowed to drive down with Bobby when he dropped it off. Marion's mother, Dinah, taught us to use a vacuum sealer on the plastic around the dope. "Put on gloves," Dinah said, tossing me an old gardening pair. "If you guys get pulled over, they'll sniff your fingernails for resin." We triple-bagged the weed and packed it into backpacks. Dinah put the backpacks into big duffel bags and covered them with beach towels, swimsuits, folding chairs, and a crate of overripe pears to hide whatever smell was left. Marion and I piled into the back seat, holding hands, our bare thighs sticking and skidding on the leather seats. We drove along the winding coastal roads, through shanty towns and orchards that drooped in the heat, past dry hills and that distant purple ridge, the cow standing motionless in the middle of a field. I had been down south before, but my mother and I had driven on I-5, not the back roads. My mother would never have stopped at the rock shop, where Bobby let us each buy a piece of agate, or the date farm, where an old man made the three of us milkshakes. They were thick, and I sucked at the straw until my mouth ached. Marion finished hers first, then rattled the straw around in her empty cup. She rolled down the window, got my attention, and let the cup tip and fall out of the car. When I looked back, the cup was bouncing silently into the weeds. "Hey," Bobby said, turning half around in his seat. He swatted at Marion, but she swung her legs out of reach. "Don't do that," he said. I was smiling, like Marion, but when Bobby's voice rose, I stopped. "Don't toss shit out of the car when it's full of pot," he bellowed, slapping his hand toward Marion. His hand glanced off her bare thigh, and I saw it redden. "You want to get us pulled over for something stupid?" he said, turning back to the road. "God," Marion cried, rubbing her leg. "That hurt." Bobby wiped his hands on the steering wheel. He glanced back at me in the rear view, and I looked away. "They just love to get you for stupid shit like that." I smiled when Marion looked at me. She wrinkled up her face, jokey again, but I saw her grip her agate. I held my own agate up to the light of the car window. It was smooth, a pale blue, banded with delicate threads of white. The woman at the rock shop said it was for grace, for flight. "Good for protection," she said, when I brought it to the counter. "Blue lace agate can help you call on angels. Also heal eczema, you know, if you get dry skin." The agate Marion picked out wasn't smooth. It was jagged and bright. "Flame agate," the woman called it. "See?" she said, lifting it, turning it in her fingers. Looks like a coal, huh? Like a hot coal. What's it gonna do for me? Marion asked, reaching out to touch it. Well, it's good for night vision, the woman said. Addiction, too, but you're young for that. You know what? She said, looking at Marion. It's just a good earth stone for power. They're all like that, Marion said. All protective, all powerful, blah. She grinned at the woman. Are there any bad stones? She said. Like, that give you weakness or stupidness or something? Yeah, or cancer, I ventured, rewarded by Marion's quick snort. The woman glanced at me as if she was disappointed, and I looked away. The woman handed Marion and me little silk pouches. Don't leave them in direct sunlight, she'd said as we left. Drains their power. When we stopped to get gas, I watched Bobby at the pump, pulling uncomfortably at his waistband. I realized that it was one of the first times I'd seen him fully dressed. He wore athletic pants made of a shiny material, borrowed sneakers, his arms crossed stiffly over the sports logo on his t-shirt. In the back seat, Marion was tossing her agate from palm to palm. Sorry, Dad yelled, she said. It's just tense. The drive? It's fine, I said. Really, I don't care. He can be a jerk, Marion shrugged, and concentrated hard on catching the agate. Yeah. Marion stopped. He's really great, too, she said, narrowing her eyes. He's a really great father, she said. We both looked up. Bobby snapped the wipers out of the way and started dragging a squeegee wetly on the windshield. Through the water and soap, the road beyond was blurry and far off. I don't think he's a jerk. I lowered my voice. Bobby was bunching up paper towels. I would never think that. We heard the high squeak of glass. Bobby had scraped the last of the water away, and the world outside the car was clear again. The clapboard of the small convenience store, the propane tanks, the highway, near and empty and without end. Bobby dropped the weed off at a Japanese temple in Burbank. While the men did business, Marion and I flicked murky water at each other and watched the goldfish in the driveway fountain gape and flash in the sun. There are no rules, Jack said, back at the ranch. He showed us anything we wanted in the barn, let us pick up mouse bones, old spinning tops, potted garlands of bulbed plants, sweet succulents we pierced with our fingernails. Don't feel like you have to ask to touch anything, he said. He let us look through pulpy books with black and white photographs of dead bodies, of bloody sheets. Oof, he said, twirling his fingers. I knew Bo before he hooked up with them. He wrote poems. Sweet, bad poems. From Jack, we learned about runes, about the Ku Klux Klan, about Roman Polanski, that men who wore rings on their thumbs were liars. When Jack excused himself to the outhouse, Marion rummaged through Grady's underwear in the bureau. Don't look through her stuff, I said. I liked Grady. He said we could touch anything, Marion said. Whoa, she crowed, holding up a pair of black lace underwear. She stuck her fingers through a slit in the crotch and wriggled them. Crotchless panties, she laughed, and flung them at me. Gross, I said. When I tossed the underwear back to Marion, she shoved them deep into her back pocket. She looked at me, daring me to say something, then moved on to the Playboys, turning each page, discussing the women. This one's real skinny, but her tits are big. Like me. Men love that. Another page, a tawny woman with an Indian cast to her face. Then the cartoons, somehow more lurid than the photographs. The bursting shirts and rounded rears, the unzipped fly. A 13-year-old girl. We talked about that a lot. What the girl might have looked like, how Roman Polanski knew her, how it had happened. Did she have breasts? Did she have her period yet? We were jealous, imagining a boyfriend who wanted you so bad he broke the law. We were drifting through whole weeks, making bonfires at night, eating 20 popsicles in a row. We made a game of hiding the wrappers, rolling them into balls and wedging them in the crotches of trees, folding them into the pages of Jack's old almanacs and religious encyclopedias. We sat in the back of Bobby's pickup as he drove the gridded vineyards and released wrappers from our clenched fists like birds. Marion was my first best friend. I never had the framed photos that girls like to give each other. I had never worn friendship bracelets or even hated anyone else with another girl. My life seemed like something new and unasked for. Marion smiling at me in the sunshine, letting me wear her woven ankle bracelet for days at a time, braiding my hair that had grown colorless and thick, full of dust and the peculiar smell of heat. Bobby often walked around wearing a sarong low on his hips, and sometimes naked, and so none of the other girls in the seventh grade class were allowed to visit, but Marion liked it like that. She pierced my ears one night with a needle, holding a piece of cold, white apple behind my lobe, and there was hardly any blood at all. She helped me trace the outline of my face and lipstick on the bathroom mirror so we could determine my face shape, heart, and the most flattering haircut, bangs, which she cut with Dinah's nail scissors. Her hot breath blowing the small cut hairs out of my eyes. We spent more and more time at the barn. Marion said that it didn't make sense to wait until a trip to town for cigarettes or mentholated pastilles when Jack would give us both for free. Marion would stare at him while he typed at his desk, on a computer he ran with extension cords to the main house, and we passed whole afternoons looking through his shelves, murmuring among ourselves, sitting Indian style on the floor. Marion smiled at him with an intensity that made her look almost cruel. I tried to smile that same way. Marion leaned up against his desk and told him about the boy who had a seizure and shat himself at the community pool. The mommies got all the kids out of the water real quick after that, she said, and waited for Jack to laugh. Marion had told me to watch him and tell her later if I thought he liked her. So I hung back, fingering the rows of books and geodes, spooning cold tomato soup into my mouth from a mug. I took note when Jack looked at the door or at Marion's slim thighs and cutoffs. Marion started volunteering to deliver messages from Grady in the kitchen to Jack in the barn, or ice cream sandwiches in the peak hours of heat. I wondered if he could feel us watching him. I never told Marion about the time I saw Grady and Jack naked, stretched out side by side on a picnic table in the yard. We're charging ourselves, Grady laughed, her eyes closed, by moonlight. Dark hair spread across her thighs and up her stomach like a sleeping animal. Jack smiled lazily, his hand on her. Marion borrowed Dinah's old Kodamatic and took me up into the hills, where she stripped and had me take pictures of her naked body laid out on rocks. You'll be good at this. I know it, she said. She tied a red ribbon around her throat like she had seen on one of the girls in Playboy. She closed her eyes, opened her mouth, and put her fingers on her flushed chest. I thought she looked really great, but she also looked dead. When we pulled the film out of the camera, letting it dry in the sun. Some faint blue shadows spread on her chest and throat. Marion tucked the photos into a box with a $20 bill, and she cut off a piece of her hair to put in there too, tied with the red ribbon. She said that was what Jack would want, that she could tell he was courtly and would understand the significance of it. She said her father had told her how hair and teeth had tightly wound cellular structures that held power. A tooth would be better, she said, and she opened her jaw wide and let me look inside her pink mouth. She pointed at a tooth on the top row, said it was loose anyway from when she'd tripped, and that she'd been working on it, tonguing it to make it even looser, pressing it as hard as she could stand with her fingers. It would be out soon, she said, and she would give it to Jack, and he would know for sure. We daubed vitamin E oil in swaths under our eyes, so that a pale glossy light caught and shone there. We looked like bright-eyed lemurs in the bathroom mirror. We're staying away for a few days, Marion said, looking at herself, running a finger around her lips. Across the swell of them, I knew she was thinking how beautiful her mouth was, because I was thinking it too. You keep men on their toes. You make them miss you. We planned our return to the barn, what bras we would wear, what we would say. Marion had written Jack's name on her body, on the bottoms of her feet, where the ink slid into the whorls. I saw it all when we changed for bed. The women were drying branches of lemon verbena and sage on tin sheets all over the yard, and a puppy Jack had dragged home from town kept nosing the sheets over. Marion was reading Archie's Double Digest with her back against a rock wall, and I was pressing tiny sequins onto my nails with glue. The day was hot, and I kept dropping the silver discs into the dirt. Marion picked a scab on her upper arm, put it in her mouth, chewed it for a while, then spat it out. That's disgusting. You're disgusting, she said, turning the page. Fuck, they don't do anything but buy hot dogs and keep girls away from Archie. The heat of the day lay on the grass like a blanket. I tried to get the puppy's attention, but some kids were tugging at it. Who do you think is prettier? Marion asked, looking thoughtfully at her comic. Betty. I don't know. She's nicer. She dresses like your mother. Which do you think Jack would like? Both, I said. I had a sequin poised over my nail, but was watching Marion to see if she'd laugh. She stood up suddenly. Let's take photos today, she said. I need to get them in the box. We pedaled the old bicycles, bouncing roughly over gravel and ruts in the path. I carried the camera on my shoulder. Marion stood up on her pedals, her legs tan, flexing. We coasted to the lake, the water thrumming with dots of flies, scrims of algae ringing the banks. Let's make these good, Marion said, briskly. You should do whatever and I'll take the picture. No. She said, breaking up a clod of weeds with a stick and looking back at the main house. You should be in them today. I took off my clothes and folded them neatly on the bank. Marion put my hands on top of my head and pulled strands of hair down in my eyes. She wedged a finger delicately between my teeth to show me how far to keep them parted. You look good, Marion said, her face hidden by the camera. She was taking pictures from far away, squatting in the dirt. You look young, really great. Then she came close with the camera, so close she touched the lens to the tip of my nipple, then cracked up and collapsed on the grass. It's hard, she gasped. I started to step into my cutoffs, but Marion leapt up and came toward me. She threw her arms around my neck, loose like a child, and kissed me with her eyes open. It's okay, she said. Pretend I'm Jack. Look sleepy, look sexy. Try to look like I do. We were breathing hard. Get my tooth out, she said. She pointed to the jagged-edged thing in her mouth that moved when she touched it. Do it with your hands, she urged. Marion was smiling. Both of us were, like idiots. I tried, but couldn't get a grip. Marion drew my fingers farther into her mouth. I was delirious. She picked up a rock and put it in my hands.
Do it,
she slurred, then took my fingers out of her mouth. Her hand was shaking. Just hit it once, hard. I looked at her, the witchy colors of twilight on her face, her eyes gone filmy and blank. Her mouth gaped, the tooth already outlined with blood. Just do it, she breathed. I lifted the rock and gave a tap. Wait, she said, recoiling. She took a deep breath. She opened her mouth then, so I could hook my fingers on her jaw. I tapped the tooth again. Mm, she said, but I hit harder and felt it give. The blood covered her chin. She just stood there, stunned, cupping her mouth with her hands. By the time I was dressed, Marion was pedaling away. When I got back to the house, she wasn't there. The puppy shuffled its nose against my foot. Bobby walked past with sheets of gray felt in his arms. I knew enough not to look for her. I went instead to the main house, to the kitchen, where it was cool and dim, and they had the radio playing. Dinah was cooking, and Grady was milking a whitish liquid from plant stalks, pulsing her fingers along the stems. They were both flushed and generous, touching me affectionately as they passed. Grady motioned for me to come sit by her. "You and Marion should be rubbing this on your faces twice a day," she told me. "You'll never get wrinkles. Ever." I smiled at them both, beaming when Grady applied the plant liquid in gentle, thorough circles under my eyes, around my mouth, between my brows. Dinah picked through beans, shuffled the wizened ones to the side, finding the hidden rot, while I sat at the counter and cut up some tomatoes from the garden. They had sunscald, their skin tight, and underneath was the hum of warm weight. I broke them open, and the seeds dripped out over my hands. Marion never showed up for dinner. I drifted off by myself, napping in the trundle bed I shared with her, in my underpants, under the coolness of her sheets. I woke disoriented in the evening light. Dinah was downstairs, calling my name. When I went into the kitchen to find her, Dinah cornered me. She grabbed me by the arm and pulled me toward her. "Marion said you kissed her. She said you hit her." She was crying and shaking. I thought of the woman sorting the beans, the sun in her hair, and how different she looked now. "Marion showed me her mouth, you stupid little girl." Grady came in behind Dinah and turned on the kitchen lights. The sudden illumination was worse, somehow, than the dark. Grady looked upset. I tried moving my shoulders, but Dinah held them tight. "You think this is normal?" She shook a picture of Marion at me, the one of her with a ribbon around her throat and her legs spread open. I covered my mouth with my hands, but Dinah had seen me smile. She shoved her face hard against mine, so her mouth was in my hair. "I know," she said into my ear. "Don't think I don't know who this was for." Grady hefted my denim backpack into the bed of the pickup and bent down next to me in the passenger seat. "Don't worry," she said, but her voice was strained. "Just give it a few days. It'll be fine." Dinah came out of the house, one of Bobby's old sweaters wrapped around her. She and Grady talked to Bobby while I sat with my head back against the seat. looking out at the yellow grasses. The fields were hazy with buckwheat, and it was almost fall again. How had we missed the buckwheat? How had we not seen the smear of it in the hills? "Just tell her mama we need a break for a while," Dinah said. "Just say we're going through some family stuff. Her mother's never around. Just say, I don't know, something. I don't care," Dinah said. I saw Dinah stalk off in the side mirror, and Bobby got into the truck and started it without saying anything. I watched the lights of the main house recede behind us, the barn rising darkly against the sky, then disappearing. My face was wet, and I was hiccuping, but I didn't feel like I was crying. I couldn't tell why my forehead was wet, too. My ears, where the water was coming from. Bobby was breathing hard, looking straight ahead as we drove the bumpy ranch roads.
"Marion's a stupid girl. You can't fuck around with teeth. She's too old. It won't grow back. I know what she was doing, and it doesn't work if you have a rotten heart. They're connected to your brain, too, your teeth, how you process pain, how you remember. Feel your teeth, how far up in your head they go?"
I ran my tongue across my gums.
"All calcium," he said.
He put his hand on my back and rubbed my bare skin up and down.
"And this, what you have here? We all used to be fish. Your spine's what's left of those aquatic skeletons."
I closed my eyes, imagining horrible fish swimming through murky, primordial waters. He told me then how the symbols were gathering around him, how it had to do with me coming into their lives, with the dreams he had of the floors of his childhood home covered with white figs, with the number of times he had found a dead deer on the ranch. His bees were disappearing, entire colonies collapsing for no reason. He found them in piles, their furred legs covered with dust and pollen. "He could feel it," he said, "a thrumming in the trees and all around, could feel that things were falling apart from the inside. Tonight confirmed it. He told me I shouldn't worry, that I was a light holder, and that things would be fine, and that I would have to stay away for a little while. Marion would call me soon, he said. We could be friends again. But I knew it wasn't true."
"You're a sweet girl," he said, his hand on my shoulder. "You're better than all of them."
Mac the Knife.
He had been sad, clinically so, but overall things had improved. It was spring. Jonathan was no longer on certain medications. His headaches had gotten better. He slept through the night. The evening was a nice one, warm enough for a t-shirt. He'd bought 5 identical ones, fairly expensive, in a rush of optimism. Now he worried that they were maybe too tight. On the way to dinner, Jonathan dropped off Annie's homework folder at his ex-wife's building. He left it with a doorman. Marin had asked that he stop coming upstairs. Hartwell had picked the restaurant. He was the only one of the three who cared enough to have an opinion. Paul and Jonathan would have been happy getting a mediocre burger at one of the old standbys, unchanged from their youth. The restaurant on Great Jones was newer, busy even on a Monday night. They had a corner table. Hartwell looked around happily, pleased, Jonathan assumed, with a sense of being a part of things, tapped into some invisible current of city living. It was unspoken that they would all get drunk. The waitress was young, but not attractive. That didn't seem to matter. She played at flirting with them. They played at flirting back.
"We've got to get the crispy squid, right?" Hartwell asked. "You like it?"
"It's fantastic," she said. Hartwell ordered the squid, as if this was a personal favor to the waitress. When she walked away, Jonathan could sense that Hartwell was almost about to say something about the waitress, but didn't. In addition to the squid, a platter of shrimp and oysters, clams, a ribeye for two that the three of them would share, crusty with pepper, a side of broccoli rabe that no one would touch. They took turns sawing at the steak on a large wooden board in the middle of the table. Jonathan flagged down the waitress to order fries. It had been almost 2 months since they'd all managed to see each other. Paul's son was waiting to hear back from colleges. "He wants to go west," Paul said, "which would be pretty great, though who knows?" His son was a sweet kid, like Paul, though both of them shared that blinkered quality, as if life had stunned them. Since his son's hospitalization, Paul had taken to wearing a necklace, a single blue bead on a cord. It was getting a little grimy, the cord a little gray. Jonathan would have made fun of it under different circumstances. They'd known each other since they were toddlers. Strange how Paul could be both the 50-year-old man and then shift there, the 13-year-old boy who was the tallest of all of them, the most handsome, some golden light on him. Paul's son's cancer had gone into remission, but Jonathan had learned from Hartwell's wife that the long-term prognosis was not good. Jonathan and Paul had never spoken about this directly. At the most recent party Jonathan hosted, attended mostly by Julia's friends, Paul had been one of the last to leave. He'd done a line of coke with Julia and her manager, then followed Jonathan around, wanting to talk, even as Jonathan puttered and cleaned, emptying the ashtrays into the garbage, dumping the dregs from plastic cups down the sink. "They should bicycle the French wine country," Paul said. "Or why not do some of the Pacific Crest Trail? Or all of it? Hadn't they always talked about that in college?" Paul had an idea for a TV show he wanted Jonathan to write. Jonathan would. They both understood. Never write this show. Neither of them would ever hike any portion of the Pacific Crest Trail. They weren't those kind of people. In the fall, when Julia had left him, Paul had called Jonathan nearly every day, checking up on him. Remembering this made Jonathan, sitting with his old friends, feel like crying. He knew that Paul loved him. Across the table, Hartwell laughed, open-mouthed, pushing his glasses up his face, Paul hacking ineffectually at the ribeye. A text from Julia. He checked his phone under the table. She was having drinks with a friend who lived in her neighborhood, some guy named Keto. He was a nice guy, claimed to have watched and even enjoyed some of Jonathan's shows. Though Jonathan's scripts were often doctored until his original idea had been wholly erased. He used to make jokes about the Ship of Theseus, back when he cared more about people thinking he was smart. Now he mostly wanted people not to think about him at all. "Still with Keto. Say hi to Hearts, etc." "Will do," Jonathan texted back. "Julia says hi," he announced. "Does she want to come meet us for dessert?" Hartwell said. "Or we could get another round somewhere else." "That's okay. She's in Gowanus with her friend," Jonathan said. "She actually met Ted last week." They'd had a 6 p.m. dinner with his father at one of the relentlessly stolid restaurants in Midtown. Big blousy light fixtures made of draped silk, a cheesy maitre d' with dentine breath by the coat check. Julia had changed twice, ended up in expensive plaid pants he had bought for her that she'd never worn before and one of his old wool sweaters. "I feel like a newsie," she said. "Did she love Ted?" Hartwell said. Hartwell was the only person Jonathan knew who actually did love Jonathan's father. Ted hosted Hartwell's entire family for an Easter weekend at the Millbrook house. Hartwell and his sporty wife, his weirdo kids.
It irritated Jonathan how tolerant his father seemed of Hartwell's kids. Even Jax, Hartwell's youngest boy, a drama queen who wore what Jonathan was pretty sure were girls' leggings, kept announcing the Mandarin word for every object in sight. Ted had merely nodded along agreeably. Hartwell and Jonathan walked down to the lake to smoke his vape pen before dinner, came back enjoyably stoned, which had been great until the ham on their plates took on some freaky cast of human flesh. Afterward, Hartwell had written a thank you note that his father still mentioned in almost every conversation. Since his mother had died, his father had grown sentimental, newly touched by such gestures. "Doubtful," Jonathan said. "No love between them. Maybe like?" His father had been on edge at dinner, talked helplessly about the renovation, stared too long at the server when she asked if he was truly finished with the Chopino. It had surprised him that his father even knew what Chopino was. Anything vaguely European used to agitate him. There had been some lulls, some silences. Julia drank too much. Jonathan too tired to really run interference. Hard to imagine his father didn't immediately run to his brothers with gossip about Jonathan's young girlfriend, barely past 30, or worse, talked to Marin. Apparently they were still in touch, another development that shocked Jonathan. He only found out after Marin mentioned it during drop-off. "You're brave, pal," Hartwell said. "I'm sure it was fine. We'll see." The waitress came back with another round of drinks, though Jonathan had already had one drink too many. Two bourbons, now this second beer. He wished he hadn't quit smoking. This was the part of the night where he might step out for a quick cigarette, drunk enough to feel all was well, that he had good friends, that he hadn't misunderstood the basic rules, hadn't ended up in a dark wood. But no more smoking. No more high cholesterol foods, or at least he was supposed to eat less of them, according to Julia, for reasons of longevity. There was a very famous artist in his 60s who lived in Jonathan's building with his wife. She was 30 years younger, now pregnant with their third child. Jonathan often passed the artist smoking on the sidewalk in front of the building, smoking furiously. Viciously, as if to hurry along death. And occasionally, Jonathan ran into him in the elevator, the artist carrying his toddler in his arms, ignoring the kid's relentless punches. Jonathan knew they had a few industry friends in common, but they'd never spoken to each other. He seemed to be, sometimes, an augur of the unhappy future in store for Jonathan. How foolish the artist looked, gray-haired, jawline blurry, carrying his young child. He looked like a gruesome old man. Once Jonathan had seen the artist with his head buried in his hands, leaning against the window of the antique store on the building's ground floor. Jonathan couldn't tell if he was crying. "Do we get dessert?" Hartwell asked. It was a pointless question. Hartwell always got dessert. Blood orange granita, sticky toffee pudding with bourbon maple ice cream. Paul scooped up bites of ice cream with a nice buzzy smile. Sweet Paul. Hartwell was telling them about some historic tree at his country house that had been resuscitated via a Japanese landscaping technique that used other tree branches. "No nails," he said. "They cut notches, slot it all together. Pretty beautiful." He'd hired a master gardener. God knows where he heard of these things. Right after Jonathan separated, when he was still in the habit of sneaking around, Hartwell let him and Julia use the house for a weekend. They stood at the island to eat shrimp cocktail out of a plastic takeout container, watched half of a movie.
They smoked a little weed from a metal vaporizer. Jonathan enjoyed cleaning the device with pipe cleaners sold especially for that purpose. Julia used a weed delivery service that only sold to women, and all the delivery people were women. Inordinately and needlessly beautiful women. At first, he wasn't sure if he could be in Julia's apartment when they came. Like, he had to avoid any taint of men. But they didn't seem to mind, or no one said if they did. The fact of a stranger in the apartment, a beautiful woman, made the situation automatically erotic, the first scene of a porno. But all of them seemed aware of this trope, and as a result, they were archly, relentlessly professional. Even so, Jonathan was always deflated when the women left, disappointed that nothing had happened, though it was impossible for him to see how anything would happen, to even conceive of what a possible first step would look like. Without discussing it, Hartwell paid the check. Hartwell had loaned Jonathan a significant amount of money. This was another thing that was never spoken of. "Hey, thanks," Jonathan said. "I'll get the next one." Did he sound convincing? "No worries," Hartwell said, signing the receipt, folding the copy neatly and slipping it into his wallet. "Up for another drink?" Jonathan checked his phone. Julia had called, then texted multiple times over the last hour. "Keto gave me ketamine. What should I do? LOL, bad idea or no?" "Going to. Come over. Where are you? Where are you?" He couldn't tell whether she was joking or not. "Julia says she has ketamine." "Really?" Jonathan shrugged. He was going to make a joke about his druggy, juvenile, delinquent girlfriend, though Julia was, in fact, nearly 32. Sometimes he caught himself making jokes about her for no real reason. "I'm curious what it's like." "Never done it," said Paul. "They're starting to prescribe it. I read an article. I think it's FDA approved." "I wonder if insurance would cover it," Hartwell said. Strange how the furtive drug-taking of their childhoods had morphed into a kind of hobby, perfectly acceptable, like an interest in wine or coffee. One of his college friends invested in a dispensary in New Jersey. Hartwell's boss microdosed. It made it all a little less fun. They were basically responsible people. They'd had too much to drink, but would be in bed by 11. Paul cleared his throat, pushed his chair back. "I should go," he said. "Make sure she doesn't kill herself." Paul lived in Brooklyn, so he and Jonathan walked toward the subway in companionable silence. Taking the train instead of a cab made Jonathan feel virtuous, on top of things. He was being responsible, wasn't he? Before they'd left, the waitress had brought them each a cellophane bag of tiny chocolate muffins, rocky with oats and nuts. "For your breakfast tomorrow," she said. Hartwell had all but waggled his eyebrows. "Thanks, Samantha," he said, putting an emphasis on the waitress's name. The waitress smiled back, but already her eyes were scanning the room. She would forget about them in exactly 1 second. Jonathan opened the bag of tiny muffins on the sidewalk, tearing the sticker with the restaurant's logo. He was drunk enough to eat the whole bag without really knowing that he was. The streets were busy, girls tugging down the hems of summer dresses they'd worn for the first warm day and now regretted. He noticed these new headphones that everyone suddenly had, headphones without cords. They looked, to Jonathan, like some kind of medical device, stents to drain brain fluid. He would likely end up buying a pair, even so, because that seemed to be how things happened, like his 11-year-old with her iPhone, though he had sworn such a thing would never be. At least Annie played spelling games, he told himself. But lately she'd become obsessed with some gothy game that required the constant purchase of gems. Julia played sometimes when she couldn't sleep. She'd gotten strangely good, stabbing the screen with a finger, her face glowing in the reflected light of a gently pulsing forest. They were almost to the subway when Jonathan saw a cab approach. He stepped out into the street, raised an arm. "Why not, right?" he said. "It's late."
"Sure,"
Paul said.
"Works for me."
"Two stops," Jonathan said, leaning in. So he hadn't taken the subway, but at least he'd intended to. And certain taxi rides at night across the bridge seemed like shortcuts to feeling good about living in the city. You could imagine they were almost true, all the things he once believed about adulthood.
"Hard to believe it's already May," Paul said. "Basically summer. You guys going to Millbrook?"
"Annie's in camp for August. Maybe Julia and I will rent out east for some of it." It was a nice thought, but unlikely. He didn't have the money for a house out there. He and Julia had gone to the beach last summer, brought a Ziploc bag filled with cherries and ice, a container of green olives, and a bottle of warm seltzer. They'd finished all the snacks on the car ride. She was a terrible swimmer, even though she'd grown up on the coast of Washington State. No one swam in the ocean there. It was too cold. She wouldn't go out past where she could touch. She worried about sand in her suit. She worried about salt water in her contacts. She pinched her nose shut every time she went under a wave. "I love this," she said, and he saw in her sunburned face that she legitimately did. She kicked away a float of algae coming toward her. "It makes you feel like a good human."
"We used to play Dead Bodies," he told her, "when we were kids. This game, we made it up. You sit where the wave breaks, and the rule is you can't use your hands. So you just get knocked around? That's a horrible game."
"It was fun," he said. And it was. The rush of helplessness, danger that was both real and not real. Paul had been the best ocean swimmer in their group of friends by far. He was the best at everything. The first to have sex, the first to do hard drugs, the first to swim out past the buoys at camp. He'd always seemed like a man, the rest of them still boys. Maybe forever.
Jonathan wanted to ask Paul if he remembered playing Dead Bodies, but Paul's eyes were closed, his arms crossed over his chest. The rush of air and noise from the open windows made it easy for Jonathan to close his eyes, too. When the taxi stopped on Paul's corner, Paul patted his pockets.
"I'll give you a 20.
"It's fine,"
Jonathan said, waving him away.
"I got it."
A queasy thought, but maybe true. These feelings of generosity just hid the part of him that wanted to keep someone around whose suffering was reliably greater than his own. Maybe Hartwell felt that way about Jonathan.
"Well, thanks, Johnny."
Paul was the only person who still called him that.
"See you soon?"
"Yeah,
yes. Say hi to Wendy."
Another 10 minutes or so in the cab till he hit Julia's neighborhood. His father had likely never been to Brooklyn.
Jonathan took his daughter here once, when he was still married. Annie seemed confused as to why they were in this neighborhood, why they'd taken a train ride just to get ice cream and walk by a dirty river. Still, she was young enough to be amiable, to trust in some overarching logic behind the things he did. They got hamburgers and hot dogs, and she held the beeper the cashier gave them like it was a cell phone and mimed taking pictures of herself.
"Love you," he texted Annie, even though she was asleep. She'd shown him once how to text a pulsing heart, but he couldn't remember how. Annie genuinely made him laugh. Sometimes it worried him to see the desperation edging her manic jokes, but maybe that was just projection. She was certainly sturdier than he had ever been, less wounded.
Even in childhood photos of himself, Jonathan thought the portent of future despair was somehow visible, a tendency toward miscalculation. Once, while fumbling for a story for Julia, he'd told her about the baby squirrel, Snoopy, that he and his nanny had rescued from Central Park when Jonathan was 6. It was strange that his parents had indulged this, but they had. Jonathan feeding the squirrel with sugar water, petting him with one finger, ferrying the tiny animal in a shoebox in his lap from 80th Street to Millbrook every weekend. After a while, his mother announced it was time to bring Snoopy back to the wild. She'd taken Jonathan to the park, pointed out all the other squirrels, all the trees for Snoopy to climb. Jonathan didn't remember whether he was sad, leaving his pet behind, only that his mother had rushed them away as soon as the other squirrels circled Snoopy, lunging and shrieking. It wasn't Snoopy. It was some other one they were attacking, his mother told him as they walked back to the apartment. It only occurred to Jonathan, as he was telling Julia this story, that of course the other squirrels had killed Snoopy. Why had he never realized that before? They could sense something soft in Snoopy, something unfit for the world. Too many hours in an old Basswegian shoebox on the Taconic, too much needless, grasping love from a 6-year-old who was afraid of everything. Darkness, moths, his older brothers. When he told Julia the story, she teared up but was laughing at the same time. Why did it make her sad? She imagined the squirrel would greet him in heaven, that Snoopy would somehow be tasked with spiriting him to the next world. She was both joking and not. Jonathan got out at the corner so the cab wouldn't have to circle around. Julia didn't answer his call. He walked in the direction of her apartment, called again. It still felt new to be back in her neighborhood, the 6 months that they were broken up long enough to estrange most everything. She had dated a co-star on her show. He was basically her age. Jonathan texted when he heard her show had been unexpectedly canceled, but she didn't text back. He only found out later that she'd been living with this new person. They didn't talk about it. Jonathan dated someone, too, a woman in her 40s with 2 kids, an administrator at a performing arts high school. Isabel was kind, interesting, endlessly accommodating. She had a dark bob and a low, appealing voice. They sent photos of their children back and forth. She texted in full sentences and with assiduous attention to grammar. After they'd kissed the first time, she'd smiled sweetly to herself, privately. Jonathan could see her resist the idea of being together, foreseeing some future pain, and then allow herself to move forward anyway. They ordered Thai food and watched actual movies, went to the dog run with her Australian shepherd. In every way, Isabel had seemed the correct person. Even breaking up with her had been easy. She made him feel he was being somehow honorable. Why hadn't he told Julia about Isabel? When he was still married, he would sometimes lie to Marin about small things. What he had eaten for lunch, what time he'd gone to sleep. It was pointless, harmless, except that it made him comfortable with the idea that reality was mutable. It was better for him and Julia to focus on the salient points. They were back together. Jonathan was officially divorced. There were no more limitations to rear up against. No background music of unfairness or tragedy. Julia had gotten what she wanted, or maybe what she had started to believe she wanted. Hard not to go along with the prevailing story, the cliché. She wanted him to leave his wife. He did not, and so on. And everyone played their part correctly.
Sometimes on those old phone calls, he could hear her lines before she said them, like they were being fed to her off stage. "You said you loved me." He made a promise. Julia was depressed. Julia picked fights. Or maybe he did. It was hard to tell. Lately, after their fights, he would lie in the darkness with his phone and scroll through old texts from Isabel, meaning to send a message, see how she was doing. He never did. It would be too disrupting, too much like the old days, how one minute his life was a cohesive thing, knowable, and then suddenly it was alien, uncanny, still recognizable, but changed in a fundamental way. Was the rebuilt ship still the same ship? He tried to explain it to Julia once, the stupid Theseus's ship thing. She barely listened. And who cared about the moment an old boat became the new boat? Maybe the real problem was that you couldn't ever make something different. That you couldn't make, say, a house, even if you replaced all your shitty old boards with new boards and really believed you might end up somewhere new, really believed you might be making a house. Even then, after all that work, you still had a boat. He had changed so much, changed everything. So it was worse, then, to look up, the dust settled, and see his life taking the same old shape. Occasionally he missed the antidepressants. He called Julia again, and she finally picked up. "Hi." Her voice sounded strange. "You okay?" "I'm on drugs," she said, then laughed. "I need you." "I'm a block away." He could see her light was on from the street. Her buzzer didn't work, so he texted her again. After what seemed like a long time, he saw movement. Through the window of the front door, he watched her make her way down the stairs. She gripped the banister. Her eyes were very wide. She wouldn't look at him, opening the second door, reaching up to unlock the deadbolt. Her hand hovered above the lock without moving. She looked, from the darkness outside, quite frightened. But when she actually got the door open, she smiled at him, big, bringing him into the light. She was wearing a long-sleeve t-shirt and her striped underwear. "Hello." She kept smiling, blinking. He laughed a little. "You were serious." "Let's go upstairs," she said. On the last flight of steps, she sank in slow motion to her knees. She smiled at him. "I'll get up," she said. He pulled her to her feet. "Jesus," he said. But it was funny. She seemed fine. He already imagined telling Hartwell this story tomorrow. The light bulb was out on her landing. He could make out piles of boxes, flattened and tied with twine, empty storage bins, a bicycle with two flat tires, her many winter coats humped over a rack. "Dirty," she said, pushing open the door. Her apartment was dark except for a floor lamp, one of her little cheapo lamps on the nightstand. So much garbage everywhere. Amazon boxes, half-unpacked plastic bags from the pharmacy, dying plants. Her manager had been sending orchids, a comically fussy present to give to someone who was depressed, struggling with basic tasks. She didn't read scripts anymore, either. These were bundled outside with the boxes. Some of the plastic bags were filled with empty water bottles waiting to be brought to the recycling downstairs. Wouldn't it be easier for her to just get a water filter? He'd stopped trying to fix what seemed to him like solvable problems. Maybe she didn't want things to be easier. When Julia was waiting to hear about an audition, she used to wake up in the mornings, frozen, unable to really speak. He would blink awake to see her bare back, turned from him, and he'd lay a hand on her, sometimes moving his hand in circles. Only many months later did he realize these were panic attacks. By the time he understood this, they'd mostly stopped. She'd taken mood stabilizers, but quit 2 weeks ago. Hard to tell if she was doing better. He could feel Julia tracking his concern for her and that his concern made her anxious. He had her sister's phone number in case things got bad again. So far, so good. Things were normalizing. He still went into other rooms to talk to his daughter on the phone. Sometimes Julia was watching a TV show on his iPad and a FaceTime call would appear. His ex-wife's smiling photo sudden in the frame. Julia dropped the iPad on instinct, as if she might somehow be visible. They were used to secrets, he supposed. All of them. A life lived parallel to real life. But now this was real life. He had to remind himself of that.
"Come to bed," Julia said. "I have to lie down."
She got under the comforter. Her laptop was open at half-mast, a folky song playing through the tiny speakers. The ceiling fan was going.
"Are you listening?"
she said.
"I love this."
Her words were slurred and mild.
"It's so pretty."
It was a cover, an old man singer he didn't recognize, but a song he knew. "You know it's actually about a killer?" he said.
"Hmm?"
"Yeah," he said. "If you listen, the words are legitimately scary."
"But it sounds so nice."
She opened her eyes.
"He gets growly there. It's good."
He took off his shoes, his pants. The song was a live recording, ending in applause. It began again. "On repeat, I see," he said. She didn't respond. They lay side by side, her hands clammy, her cold feet touching his ankles. When they first met, she'd never landed a real job. That had been years ago. She had a publicist now, a manager, though these days there was nothing for them to do. She pointed at the nightstand. Among her prescriptions, her retinol, a protein bar wrapper, there was a little black scale, a clear plastic bag printed with Adidas logos. "Slick," he said. She smiled with her eyes closed.
"Very chic,"
she said, her voice petering out.
"Keto didn't want it. I think you should do some."
He was drunk enough to feel happy lying there with her. Unconcerned. Nothing was wrong. She sometimes looked especially young, like she did that night. Her skin had evened out after a course of antibiotics, much to her delight. Her lips were very chapped. He loved her.
"You have to snort it?" he said.
She shrugged.
"It's nice. It's weird."
She kept opening her eyes as if suddenly jolted awake. He checked his phone, got up to plug the charger into the wall. He took off his shirt, got back in bed. She studied his hand, rubbing her bare thigh in the dim room.
"I have asparagus legs," she said, making herself laugh.
"Oh, really?"
"Yes."
She lifted one leg and then the other, squinted at him.
"You're in the music video," she said. "Did you see it? You look like you're in the background with all the smoke and the, what is it, ladders, scaffolding."
She sat up with great effort.
"Wow,"
she said.
"You do it."
She balanced the electronic scale on a book, narrowing her eyes at the buttons.
"I'm going to do more, too," she said, "but just a little."
She tipped out white flakes onto the scale. The numbers blinked and reset. Very professional, he said. How much are you supposed to take?
I actually, she said, don't know. The scale doesn't work. But it was. It did.
She snorted half a line through a loosely rolled dollar bill.
Yuck, he said. I make you one, she said. It's really not bad for you. You can't die or anything. Did she sound slightly manic?
He took the bill from her to re-roll it more tightly. In college, he had a little cocaine problem. Had even been famous on campus for the prodigious amounts he could take down in a night. Not much else to do in the New Hampshire woods, there with the same kinds of people he'd grown up with and gone to high school with. The unchanging cast of his whole life. That year in college had probably been the only time until the divorce that he'd actually done anything wrong, made choices that felt even a bit dangerous. And maybe it had even been disappointing how quickly that period had passed, how there had really been no consequences. A semester off to travel, to cool it with the drugs, but that was it. He graduated on time, was herded into the predictable grooves of his adult life. It was almost like nothing had ever happened. The song had played a few times through. Children of the Darkness. I like it. She was lying down again. He touched her thigh, her crotch through her underwear. She didn't respond. What's your shirt? It was cluttered with black and white graphics. A sun, a pair of dice, a grainy photograph. It was unusual for her.
Do you like it?
Sure. She stretched out her arms to study the shirt.
So you like it?
What?
My shirt.
He rolled his eyes.
Yes. I should take my contacts out.
Together they blinked up at the ceiling fan. Can we listen to something else? He said. She muted her computer.
Okay.
She clicked around the trackpad with one limp finger.
You'll do some, right? You'll like it.
He was ridiculous. A ridiculous old man doing drugs.
Sure, he said. He didn't have his daughter till Friday. There was nothing that desperately needed to get done anytime soon. Just notes on a show he no longer cared about. A show that would likely never get made. At a certain point, he stopped hoping things got made and started wishing for kill fees. You need anything? I'm getting us water.
She didn't answer. Her kitchen was tiny. More of a corner, really. Her freezer had been left ajar, emitting a breath of chilly light. He shut it. Julia had taken out a fresh trash bag, but only draped it on the lid of the garbage can. He would fix all this in the morning, take the recycling downstairs, maybe try to get a light bulb for the hallway. He drank a glass of water, looking out into the many dark yards of the neighbors, the city beyond the tops of the brownstones. It was a pleasing scene, the lights of the tall buildings in the distance and the human scale of the apartments. He rinsed the glass and left it dripping on the dish rack. When he returned to the bedroom, he saw Julia's eyes were filled with tears.
Gee,
she said, her voice mawkish.
But I'm not really sad.
She looked scared. He petted her hair, took the scale from her, and put it on the nightstand. Tears fell down her cheek, running into her hair.
It's okay, she said.
It hurt him, suddenly, to see it. How plain it was. She was trying so very hard. Still waiting to find out whether this would turn out to be a bad story or a good one. He used to visit her in her old apartment. It was a time when he would bring her things he thought she'd like. Tins of pastilles, books, a cardigan the color of a grapefruit. Her bed was lofted, close to the ceiling.
It was summer, and there were occasionally silverfish skittering into the corners. He ordered her silverfish repellent off Amazon, bought her a window unit when July rolled around, though he wasn't there to help her install it. It made him feel collegiate to have sex in a bed you had to climb a ladder to get to. She'd been taking sleeping meds then, and used to call him with weird hallucinations, a dark-cloaked figure waiting at the bottom of the ladder, urging her to roll out of bed. "It made sense, 'cause I was so afraid of accidentally falling out," she'd said. "I was so afraid, and I just wanted it to happen. So then I could just do it and stop being afraid it was going to happen." He remembered that time fondly, though this was the period of their relationship she seemed to bring up most often in fights, crying so hard she was gasping. "You left me alone," she would say. "You left me."
"Maybe we can spend some time at the beach this summer," he said. "You liked it."
Julia was breathing softly. Her face was wet, but she had stopped crying. She put on some classical music. It surprised him she even had it on her computer.
"Remember," he said, "we'll play Dead Bodies."
"Dead Bodies," she said.
"It'll be great. I'll teach you to swim in the ocean."
As he said the words, he believed them. In truth, he was not a strong swimmer. She opened her eyes but didn't say anything, just watched him. He bent over the scale and snorted the line. She hadn't crushed it fine enough. Maybe this had been dumb. He dipped down and finished it.
"You won't even feel anything in the morning," she said. They had gotten everything they wanted. "Because it's very pure," she said. "One of the 30 pure drugs in the world."
Then she laughed, her eyes closed.
"What am I even talking about?"